Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Welcome to Nature Now for the fourth week of October. I'm Charlie Fleischman, sound engineer and editor of this long-running program. I'm mostly behind the mic, helping Nan Evans, Debron Kelso, and Mary Robson bring you interesting and important interviews and news from the natural world. But today I'm sitting in to introduce our schedule for the next 3 weeks. We'll be presenting encore broadcasts without the usual weekly observations and upcoming events, starting with today's show, which previously aired in November of 2015. The following 2 weeks will feature broadcasts recorded during the April 2016 Fun Drive, with the Nature Now hosts reading excerpts from some of their favorite books and sharing their reading recommendations. And included will be a replay of several mystery sounds from earlier programs. The Nature Now team hopes you've enjoyed many of our nearly 300 broadcasts and will show your appreciation for our program by supporting KPTZ during this fun drive. The quickest method is to go to kptz.org and click on the Donate Now button or call 360-554-4430 to connect with one of our Fun Drive volunteers.
I'm Nan Evans. My guest this week is ecologist, writer, and philosopher, Dr. Carl Safina. Dr. Safina is the author of more than 100 scientific and popular publications. His work has been featured in the National Geographic and in the New York Times. Audubon Magazine named Dr. Safina among the 100 notable conservationists of the 20th century. His first book, Song for the Blue Ocean, was chosen as a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Earlier this fall, Dr. Safina participated in a special event in Seattle, linking the fates of our Pacific Northwest salmon and killer whales. At that time, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to interview Dr. Safina about his most recent book, titled Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Quoting a New York Times review of the book, Dr. Safina is a terrific writer, majestic and puckish in equal measure, with a contagious enthusiasm. Dr. Safina draws out haunting resonances between animal lives and our own. Let's listen to that pre-recorded interview.
So the first question I want to ask you about your new book, Beyond Words, it seems to me that's an almost controversial topic, certainly unusual for a scientist to take on. And I was interested, what compelled you to write it?
A few things compelled me to write it. Mainly, I wanted to just show who we are here with on Earth. Not just what we are here with, but who. What are lives like for these other creatures that share the world with us? That's the main reason.
Boy, I like that. It just sort of speaks to my heart. And I should say I've admired you for years, ever since Song for the Ocean. So this is really special, you know, treat for me. And I was thinking about, as you do that work, trying to figure out who these other creatures are and how they communicate. I guess I have to reflect from a human perspective. I find communicating with humans is often really difficult, I mean, just because of our own limits to communication.
Right.
How can scientists and how do people like you clue in to communications in the non-human animal world?
Well, it's not only about how they communicate. It's how they experience their lives. So it's just what life is like for them, how they know who they are with, who their families are. You see them traveling together sometimes for decades. They know who they're with. They recognize their families. They know their friends. They know who their rivals are. They know where they are in their territories. Their behaviors make sense because they are making sense of the world. And if you look at them, you see that. Usually we don't look at them.
Mm-hmm.
We just say, oh, there's whatever it is. There's an eagle.
Mm-hmm.
There's
a, we there's, have a tendency to name things.
There's a killer whale. And you might be excited even to get a glimpse, but you don't watch their lives. And there are a few people around who have watched their lives in this
over
region.
Long periods of time.
Oh, well, in this region, yeah. Ken Balcom mm-hmm. has watched killer whales for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
He understands who they are and what they're doing, and he can translate that into human terms because he's a human being. But it took him 40 years to be able to do that. And those are the kinds of people that I chose as my interpreters in approaching this book and the free living animals that are in the book to tell the stories of what their lives are like. But you can also look at their brains and how their brains are similar to our brains, and that similar in structure, similar in the way that they're wired to things like eyes and ears, mm-hmm. similar hormones and other brain chemicals that drive mood and motivation in humans, that create this feeling of bonding with our loved ones. They all have all of that.
So the more we have learned about how our own brains work, we can learn and transfer that to similarities in
well, we've
non-human
learned, we've
animals,
learned
so.
About how their brains work also. We've learned a lot about them over the last 50 years or so. 50 years ago, we knew almost nothing. We knew vastly less about how brains mm-hmm. function, vastly less about brain chemistry, vastly less about how we are related, and nothing at all about what they do or who they are. Now we know those things.
So when you look at brain chemistry and you look sort of across the various phylums or even lower classes or orders, how much similarity is there across the spread of animals in the brain chemistry?
Everything in life is on a continuum. And so those animals that appear most like us and behave most like us, mammals, they are most like us.
Mm-hmm.
They're structured most like us.
But do you think the brain chemistry is fundamentally very similar in the vertebrates?
Yes, in the vertebrates, it is fundamentally very similar, and it's essentially identical in all mammals,
mm-hmm.
and mammals and birds, very similar, you know, and it just sort of, it grades into slight differences. But one thing that is really, I think, almost incredible is that some of the brain chemicals that we have that create our sense of bonding and that motivate us in love are actually present in things like worms.
Really?
And, yes, really.
Sorry, so, really?
So that doesn't mean necessarily that they're doing the exact same thing with mm-hmm. those chemicals, and but it means something. And when you mess up their levels of those chemicals in worms, their mating behavior is messed up. So it's driving them to be motivated in some way. I'm not going to tell you that I know what a worm feels, but the scientific article talking about this discovery was called The Mood of a Worm. Not something we think about every day.
Not really. Interesting. Although I volunteer at our Marine Science Center, and I know the octopus has moods.
Well, it's
an amazing creature. Yeah.
Yeah, octopuses or octopi, depending on how Latin you want to be.
Right.
They are exceptionally intelligent. They use tools as well as do most mm-hmm. apes, and they recognize human faces.
And they do.
They yeah. are extraordinarily intelligent, and they're not even vertebrates. You know, mm-hmm. they're mollusks, for goodness
yeah.
sake. When you dial it all the way down to things like worms, and then you take it all the way back to things like an elephant or a killer whale, they are essentially identical to us. And the main differences are mostly of amount, not of mm-hmm. not of kind.
Basic
you know.
Character.
It's almost as if we're just wearing different skins and got pushed into slightly different shapes. I mean, whales still have all the same finger bones mm-hmm. that we have. They haven't even lost their fingers in those flippers.
Yeah, a pianist friend of mine who's not a biologist looked at the whale skeleton at the Port mm-hmm. Townsend Marine Science Center, and that's what fascinated her,
mm-hmm.
is the
right.
the finger.
They still have hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just like some of us are outfitted for hiking and some of us are outfitted for diving.
Mm-hmm.
And they give birth, they know who their babies are, they make milk for them, they nurse them. It's just very, very similar.
So I'm getting the sense that this sort of fundamentally says to humans, wake up, we're not as different or as separate from the animal world as one might have been trained to think.
That's certainly true. And we're not as, so we'll leave it at that.
Okay. What's actually one question. I'm not even sure if it's, from that perspective, how relevant it really is. But, you know, I was trained as a zoologist, and I remember professors being very rigid about don't anthropomorphize.
Yes.
And how do you see that filter?
I think it's ridiculous.
Okay.
You know, the idea that you may not attribute human thoughts and emotions to other animals is totally unscientific, because in science you're supposed to be asking what's really going on, mm-hmm. not what am I allowed to think is going on, or what am I allowed to see is going on. And because they have the same imperatives as we, they need to stay alive, keep their babies alive, find food, mate. And because they have essentially identical brains, attributing human thoughts and emotions to them is the best first guess about what they're doing and why they're doing mm-hmm. it. So from that standpoint, then you start watching and you learn more about what's really going on. But it is not scientific to say they're hungry when they're attacking prey mm-hmm. and they're exhausted when they're resting. Mm-hmm. And then when they're playing, say, I have no idea what could possibly be going on in their minds or whether they can think at all. That's not scientific. You look at their brains and you look at their behavior, and the simplest conclusion is that they're doing what you think they're doing for the reason you think they're doing it. Then you look and you watch and you learn mm-hmm. more and better.
I think in reading something about your new book, it talks about the emotions, the emotions we know, joy, grief, sadness. I guess maybe tell me a story of seeing that range of emotions in a creature, sort of any creature.
Oh, God. Well, there are so many stories that it would take a few minutes for me to even figure out like which one to pick. Well, with elephants, for instance, you can usually see that when they get around water and when they have a lot of babies, it's a very happy time for them. And there's a lot of playing. There's a lot of using up energy that you don't have to use up just for staying mm-hmm. alive. There's just fooling around, thrashing around in the water, spraying water back and forth, hitting the water just to see it splash. And you can see that they're just having fun. And you can also see that many elephants nowadays are very fearful about things, because mm-hmm. they get attacked a lot by human beings. Mm-hmm. And it's not remarkable, because they've had this capacity forever, and they've been watching us for a lot longer than we've been mm-hmm. watching them. But it is remarkable in the sense that these things that are true about them and the world have never occurred to us before. And one of those things is, if you hide a speaker in the bushes, and through that speaker you play the recorded voices of tourists, the elephants ignore it, because they hear tourists talking in their vehicles and tourists never bother them. If from the same speaker you play the recorded voices of the herders who carry spears and sometimes hurt or kill elephants in confrontations at waterholes with their cattle, they run away from those voices. Mm-hmm. They know that there are different kinds of human beings, and different kinds of human beings treat them differently. They know that. They're aware of it. They know what's going on in their life. Hmm.
Is there much variation in the animal world, in a species, of how they react emotionally to the same stimulus? I mean, what I'm thinking about is...
Yeah, well, that's called personality.
Yeah, I mean, I think about my husband and I. We mm-hmm. react very differently to oftentimes the same stimulus.
In every animal where people have looked for personality, they have found it. And what that means is, presented with the same situation, they react differently. Mm-hmm. Some are shy, some are inquisitive, some are bold, some are confident, some are retiring.
And you can see that if you watch, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I saw lots of individual personalities among the wolves, for instance, mm-hmm. that I was watching. they respond really differently. And basically, all the animals that you look at long enough to get to know them well, you see those kinds of differences. And I think some more than others, but you do see those mm-hmm. kinds of differences. But if you just see, you get a fleeting glimpse, or you spend a day or a few hours, or you're looking at birds and you're just saying, well, that's a jay, and that's a crow, mm-hmm. and that's a gull, you're not going to see things like that. It takes time.
Do you think animals have culture?
All these questions, you have to clarify what you mean by those words. Mm-hmm. So culture is a way of doing things that is not inborn, but is learned.
And passed down, or...
Well, it's not, it's learned. Every generation has to, the individuals have to learn it. And some animals have culture, and again, that's a range. Mm-hmm. Some, I think, do not, and some do. Some, for instance, learn how to make certain tools, like chimpanzees, in part of their range, use stone tools, and in other parts of their range, where there are stones, they don't use stone tools. They use sticks and mm-hmm. reeds and things like that. That's a cultural difference.
Well, it seems the more I read about the orca, it seems like the orca pods are cultures. They're
cultures, and they're incredibly complicated as cultures, because the idea that some of these residents mix and mingle to varying degrees, and then they don't mix or socialize at all with the adjacent community, mm-hmm. the northern and southern community, that's really very, it's so strange that there's nothing like that known in any other kind of animal mm-hmm. in the world, that members of the exact same species simply don't ever, they refuse, I guess you could say, but they just don't ever socialize, even though they get close enough to one another to certainly know that, mm-hmm. that they're there. And then there are other groups that socialize all the time. Every time they're near each other, they go and mix and visit and mingle around, and they know who they are, and then they go back to their own pods and to their own
mm-hmm. families, groups,
natural
or tribes.
Lines. Yeah.
Another question is, I again was reading the reviews about your new book. I was sort of reflecting, I was a young woman when the feminists stuff and the writings of that era, there was mm-hmm. seminal works that talked about differences in matriarchal and patriarchal cultures and the stereotypes of violence or cooperation or so on.
You definitely want to be in a matriarchal species.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was my conclusion at that time.
Elephants, orcas, bonobos, they're nicest to one another, and they're the most peaceful.
So that, and it is a stereotype of that thing. It applies in the animal world.
Well,
also,
you see it.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something that you do see.
Yes, you're right. You do want to be in a matriarchal world. I guess maybe the last question to ask you about your book is, what's the takeaway that you hope people who read it then take and incorporate into their own being?
Well, I hope that people can see that we are not the only lives here, and we're not the only lives that matter or that are valid mm-hmm. on this planet, that all these other creatures are as interested in staying alive as are human beings. In fact, you could even say more so. They don't commit suicide. They don't say, oh, what's the use of living? They go full on to just do what it takes
to live
and to keep their young ones alive, the ones that take care of their young ones, mm-hmm. all the mammals, all the birds, some of the others. And they put all their effort into that. And many of them have senses that are much sharper and keener and much more vivid than ours. Mm-hmm. And they're more alert in the world. So they have a more vivid experience of living, I think, than we do. Every bit as good a reason to be here. Since they don't damage anything, you could say they have more of a reason mm-hmm. to be here than we do. So a lot of humility, I think, is an appropriate response to seeing who we're here with. And earlier in the history of Western civilization, we just thought like we were it. And then we met all these other different cultures. And we thought, oh, we're better than them, or they're subhuman. Mm-hmm. We had all these things. And we apply a lot of that same thinking to the non-human beings.
Well, there was a lot of that man versus nature stuff.
Oh, man versus man.
And yeah, I'll give you that one too. Yeah.
Calling people from other cultures and other races subhuman as an excuse to do whatever thing we wanted to do to exploit or abuse them. And we do that now. It's still acceptable now to do that to non-humans and to not think about them. I mean, if you don't think that they think or feel anything, mm-hmm. you don't have to worry about what they think or feel about anything you do to them, whether you make it impossible for them to exist or you capture them or do, you know, all the things that we do.
So it's like changing the morality of how we think about the world. It's like,
I think
the ethics, maybe.
I think that your sense of right and wrong would change if people better understood what life is mm-hmm. like for these other creatures and how much they'd like to hang on to it.
So thank you. Thank you for half an hour of your time.
Thank you.
Tune in next Wednesday at noon to hear the first of two book recommendation shows. Nature Now repeats on Thursday at 5 p.m. and Saturday at 11:30 a.m. Podcasts are available on the KPTZ website soon after. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to donate by going to kptz.org or by calling 360-554-4430.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, performed by Peter, Paul, and Mary.
And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe, if you don't know by now. When the rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on. Don't think twice, it's all right. It ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. It ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. I'm on the dark side of the road. Still, I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. We never did too much talking anyway, so don't think twice, it's all right. I'm walking down that long, lonesome road, babe, where I'm bound, I can't tell. But goodbye is too good a word, gal, so I'll just say fare thee well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind, you could have done better.